December the 9th, 1943. I can't take much more of this bloody rain. It's time we had a rest. I must have been depressed, because on this day, my diary is empty. Files a diary. I'm getting fed up with myself here. I will be glad when we move or go for a rest. Regimental diary. Body of a soldier reported lying dead in passage in RHQ. I checked. It wasn't mine. It turned out to be an engineer who had committed suicide. Lucky bastard, said Nash. I think we were all feeling like that. At 15:13 hours came orders that might have saved his life. 17 and 19 batteries were moved to rear positions for refitting and rest. The news fell like a bombshell. It galvanized smile back on our faces. We were walking around and saying, like Mr. Barrett to Elizabeth, you must rest, my dear. I gave the orders from the command post to all the guns. Cease fire, prepare to move. We could hear the cheers come back over the headphones. The tempo changed as though we'd all been given a shot of adrenaline. I got radio AFN and plugged it through to all the gun tannoys. We danced with each other all day. December the 10th, 1943. Today we go back. Griffin enters G-truck bivvy, a garland of withered flowers on his unshaven head, a blanket toga fashion draped around his ungainly body. Beware the Ides of March, he says. Beware the clap of Naples, we reply. Under 30 went on. I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The shovels in the lorry. The evil that men do live after them. We must fill the shit in before we leave. Never mind all this, we got to clean out the battlefield. Bombardier Fuller, known back home as Stop Thief, is passing on the command post orders of our major. Soon, carol-singing gunners are roaming muddy fields, gathering fag ends, packets, bottles, dead mule tins, and place them on a funeral pyre. As the flames roar up, a cry. Anyone for Sutty? Other guns are firing, but not us. Wasn't it lovely? We stand and watch the sweating gunners on the 3-7s. When they loose off around, we all cheer, and they tell us to piss off, or they'll turn the guns on us. Nasty men. In the command post, Lieutenant Walker, MID, has liberated the soul of the duty signaller and specialist with excerpts from a whiskey bottle. We start rolling in the telephone lines and dismantling the equipment. I could do this with my eyes closed, said Ernie Hart. Try it then, Shapiro. He did, and dropped in the mud. Stand by to move. What we are supposed to stand by, they do not say. I chose a tree. You never know. You might need it. I had kung-fued my kit into my pack and kit bag. I had wrestled my tent to the ground, got a half-Nelson on the tent pole and heaved it from the earth, and then, with great javelin throw, I had hurled the lot into the back of the G-truck. Oh, fuck! But the truck is not empty. Through his burnt binoculars, Major Jenkins has spotted some rubbish in yon field, and he sends yon gun a haul, and we can hear yon swearing from him. Yes, we are all ready to move. All the rubbish has been packed up, and the pits filled in. Yes, Edgerton reflects, we've done everything but strew fresh grass seed. Yes, we were ready to move. We stand by our vehicles, all smiling, and as I say, ready to move. We warm the engines up, ready to move. We clean the windscreens, ready to move. Oh, yes, we were ready to move, I said. And I said so. I'm ready to move, aren't you? I said to Edgerton, and he said, oh, yes, I'm with you on that. As sure as I am 954022, I am ready to move. For 3 hours, we are ready to move. And then 4, 5, and 6 hours, ready to move. They're all falling silent. On the 7th hour, Bombardier Dean said, I think somebody's fucked it up. Lieutenant Walker is passing with a bemused smile on his blonde face. He turned and said, what are you waiting for? Anything, we said. He paused, then walked on towards his truck, where he turned about and shouted, if it's any consolation, I'm as pissed off as you are. We gave him a big cheer. There's a big hold-up on the Tiano Road, said BSM Griffin, trying to help.
There's a bigger fucking hold-up here, said Jamjar. I'm going to see a lawyer.
Give him my love, then, said Griffin. All night we sat and froze, with only tea and bread scrounged from the cookhouse truck as a relief. In painful positions, we tried to sleep out the rain-filled night. It was like being tied up in a sack and thrown in the Bosphorus. The growling of empty stomachs rings around the valley. At the sound of a snore, a sleepless voice says, lucky bastard. I have had my legs in every position except behind my neck,
and I'm saving that for an emergency. I'm just dozing off with my legs behind my neck when the truck jolts forward.
Mummy, Mummy! I shake Dean gently by the throat. Get the bucket and spade, Mummy. We're off.
Along the dawn-haunted roads we slush along. By now life has so little interest that an announcement that the world was coming to an end could only have cheered us up. I'm dozing, dozing, smoking, dozing. Isn't that Betty Grable I can see?
Wake up! Wake up! We're all here! We're all here!
Deans is clambering out of the truck. Sleepily I follow, and where are we? It's a farm. We are in a large courtyard, flanked by a large four-storied red brick Victorian Gothic building with a circular Camelot-type tower, along with numerous other utility buildings. The courtyard was knee-deep in crap. We donned our wellies. We are all assigned a building. The specialists and signallers are given what is a shed being used as a coal bunker.
You have to clear it up if you want to get comfortable, said Sergeant King.
I dumped my kit on the coal dust-laden floor. Can't we burn it and start again, I said.
There was the sorting out where to keep time lag, and then at 10:30 breakfast, by which time most of us had forgotten how to eat it. Hard on that, we parade for Captain Sullivan.
As you can see, this yard has been crept in for the last 100 years by chickens, cows and sheep, etc.
Was he going to say, now it's our turn?
If we've got to spend Christmas here, we don't want to spend it up to our neck in shit. So we've got to set to and clean it up, and the sooner the better.
He then left us to clean up the shit, while he went away not to.
The lad set to with shovels, but I could see that it was going to take days. I put the great Milligan brain to work, and I came up with the answer. Some large, squared-off timbers lay around, the thickness of tree trunks. They were about 12 feet long by about 4 foot square. To these we attached dragging ropes, and, by pulling them along the yard and up a slope, we deposited the crap into an adjacent canal. Any chicken that tried to crap here now got a brick on the back of his nut. Clouds of black coal dust swirled in the air as we set about our shed. We got so black that soon the strains of a tune came. Old Man Reba, that old man Reba. And then there appeared what appeared to be Negro gunners doing the cakewalk.
I don't think this was always a coal bunker, said Black and Deans. It's been used as a garage at times.
Oh, what a relief, I said. These little bits of unsolicited information do wonders for us. It was a weary bunch of gunners that bedded down that sooty night. With their usual ingenuity, each man had concocted a bed of sorts. The most painful was Gunner Devine's. He slept on a sheet of corrugated iron. It made the most devastating clanging noise every time he moved. December the 12th, 1943. My diary. Christmas is coming! Cold and rain. Continue to shovel shit and coal dust. After the overnight rain, the courtyard had refilled with crap, and so we start all over again. The signallers and the specialists attacked the billet. They enlisted Ted Wright, who drove the water cart in and turned the taps on. There is nothing to report for the days that followed, save the horses. The fallow fields and meadows around house a collection of horses and a few donkeys. A ride wouldn't be a bad thing. With this in mind, the gunners Devine, Nash, White and Milligan strode manfully over the canal bridge and closed in on three shaggy-looking equines. At our approach, they looked up, ears cocked forward. With lots of outstretched hands and utterances,
"Good boy, ear boy,
whoa, and come here, you bastard." We managed to get one to stand still while Vic Nash prepared to mount. Had he ridden before? He thought so. Up he goes. He sat there for a few moments, saving the height, being a short ass. This was all new to him. He lights a cigarette. "Never mind the bloody fag, get the thing going," I said. Devine was anxious to see the display. White was somewhere, chasing a brown filly that had almost taken him out of sight. We heard him shouting gentle implorations, but now he was down to slinging lumps of turf after the reluctant creature. Here, however, Nash was preparing. He threw his cigarette away, and then to the animal. "Come on. Off we go." He didn't. "Off we go." He tried several more. "Off we go."
But she didn't offer to go, but she went off for grazing. Get her head up, will you? He instructed us. This done, he tried a sudden use of the heels, and in doing so, it fell off.
Thought you said you could ride, said Devine.
I thought so too, insisted Nash. Devine helps him up again, but they still argue.
There doesn't move yet, and you've fallen off.
Well, it takes time to get back into the swing of it. And when I say ready, give her a smack in the arse. Right, right. Nash settles, takes a firm hold of the rope and the mane. Right, yell. Devine connects with his palm with a rump. Smack. We help Nash up again.
I don't think I'm going to be able to remember, he said.
Devine pats the horse.
I can do better than that. I've never ridden, but it should be easy. I've seen tons of cowboy pictures. They never fall off.
Milligan and Nash hold hands as a step. Devine is on. He smiles in triumph. Devine is off. White has come running back. He has chased the brown horse out of the province. He settles now for a donkey. Great. He's on. He stays on and manages to get the animal to run around.
Anyone got a camera before it's too late, he shouts.
After the trials of Cowboy Devine, I got on and rode the horse at a canter around the muddy fields. I hadn't ridden since I was a boy in India. I'd forgotten how wonderful it was, and that smell peculiar to horses. We messed around like this until we heard a terrible yell and a splash. Nash is in the canal. Devine had challenged him to leap across, and he failed. Devine is laughingly helpless as Nash thrashes the shit-strewn waters and swears his way to the bank where Devine holds him up, only to find himself back on the same side he'd jumped from. There is a shivering run by Nash along the canal to where the bridge is, some quarter of a mile away. He divests himself of his now reeking battle dress and hangs it outside to dry. It's past redemption. The smell is appalling. He tries to exchange it at the queue stores, but had only been in there for 2 minutes when everyone ran out. When he ran out after them, they all ran back in again. They told him to get it washed and it would be all right. The farmer's wife fainted when he showed it to her. Finally, he boiled it. It killed the smell, but the suit shrank 12 inches. In a fit of desperation, he put it on. His appearance at the queue store sufficed to point the need for a new one. Alas, the new one was 2 feet longer than him. The moral is, don't go riding. But many persisted. Every evening, the meadows were full of galloping horses with gunners hanging around their necks. The Italian farmer wondered why, every morning, his horses were too shagged out to pull the wagon. He reported this to the major, and part two orders read, "The practice of riding farm animals in off-duty hours will cease forthwith. The animals are only for agricultural use." "Thank Christ it's all over," said Nash from somewhere inside a battle dress. Ah, the Army Kinematographic Corps have visited us. They set up their cinema in our billets. There's to be 3 shows starting at 3, second house 6, last house 9.
"Signalers and specialists in the last batch," said Sergeant King.
Bloody nerve. It was our billet. We had to move all our beds and wait outside until 9 o'clock at night. We all stroll over to the tower where Edgington and a mob are in a frenzy of pontoon. Lear notes are piled in the middle, and like true punters and sportsmen, their faces are a mask of utter misery. Smudger Smith is banker. They've been playing for nigh 4 hours, and the total winnings are somewhere in the neighbourhood of 12 shillings. There could be suicides before the night is out.
"Stand by me, Milligan. You're Irish. Bring me luck," said money-mad Edgington.
Strange enough, his luck did change. He lost the lot. Some of the lads had seen the 3 and 6 o'clock shows and knew it by heart. The film was Casablanca, dubbed Casablanco, with Humphrey Gocart. Every entry by Bogart was greeted with, "Now, listen, boys." Ingrid Bergman got, "Have you had it yet, darling?" Bogart in Casablanca town was repeatedly warned, "The invasion is coming. Piss off before you're conscripted." At one stage, as Bogart was nonchalantly putting his hands in his pockets, a warning to Bergman, "Look out, darling, he's going to show you the white-eared elephant." Claude Rains' entry was greeted with, "Here comes the weather report." When Bogart's victim fell to the ground, there was, "Stretcher bearer!" Kissing was greeted by 200 gunners making suction noises. I can never watch that film again. I report in full Alf Files' diary.
It gives an interesting insight as to what an ordinary soldier was thinking on that day 35 years ago. Cinema show in our garage, so we're out all day till it's our turn. Good film, Casablanca. Lots of barracking. Humphrey Bogart, Ingrid Bergman and Claude Rains. But maybe rather lovesick and homesick, nevertheless very entertaining. Most of the lads sweeping up muddy courtyards along with parades. Maintenance with Milligan leading mad moments of his latest invention called drooling. A new game with effects on victims, who are pounced upon with verbal hoots and gorilla-like groans. How mad we all are when there's a war on and no artificial pleasures. Jerry still holding his winter line cleverly with machine guns and mortars, but Fifth Army gaining yard by yard. Tuesday, December the 14th, 1943. Mobile shower unit has arrived. Naked gunners all over the place. Steam, soap, whistling, songs, prank. A quartet of naked men are standing in barbershop formation. Edgington, Milligan, Divina White. The water cascades down them, patent leathering their hair, their heads. Water jets run off their noses, elbows and willies. We're poor little sheep. We have lost our way. Ba, ba, ba. This is all done with a fine feeling for dramatic gestures. Arms shoot up in all directions. Occasionally the steam would obscure them completely. We sang for nearly an hour. When we came out again, we were all bright red. I feel giddy, said Edgington. It's the loss of dirt, I said. It leaves you dizzy. Having given us a shower, we are now told to don our denims and clean the underside of all those signal vehicles. An hour later, we are all shit black again. As luck would have it, the shower unit was still working. Soon from the steam came, we're poor little sheep, we're lost our way. The bath corporal said,
here, weren't you lot in this morning?
Yes, you're only supposed to have one go. This is only one go, I said.
This is the second time you've been in. I recognise the singing.
Oh, fame at last. He forthwith switched off the water. We were all left naked, covered in soap and shivering.
I'm not having this, said Divine, who runs after the corporal.
Soon the waters flow again, but then it went off again, and on again, and off again. We could hear a scuffle out back somewhere, then the thud of a body falling to the floor. Divine reappeared with a turncock. He had blood coming from his mouth.
The bastard, I told him.
What happened? Simple. The bath corporal now lay unconscious by his control valve.
Hurry up, then, said Divine.
I didn't hit him very hard. Thursday, December the 16th, 1943. Regimental diary. RA band visited 10 Corps area and gave performance in Teatro Garibaldi at Santa Maria and Capua Ventre. My diary. Only 8 shopping days left to Christmas. Oh dear, I must hurry. File diary. Still no Naples or rest, but plenty of graft. Graft, yes. We are cleaning and re-cleaning our signal equipment. I can't clean this wireless set any more, Sarge.
Why not?
It's starting to scream. Afternoon. All ranks, other than those on guard and regimental duties, will proceed to Santa Maria for the RA band concert. The Garibaldi Theatre fronted a muddy street. The interior was a wonderland of plasterwork, gilt, marble columns and red velvet. Built in 1840 in classical style, it would be a showplace anywhere. Right now, the RA band are pumping out Colonel Bogey. We listen to a few Sousa marches and then off out. Ah, the American Red Cross cinema. That was for us. Oh, it's full. Round the back to the rear of the stage. Files White and I lay on our backs on the reverse side of the screen and watch George Brent and Mary Astor in a film I think called Yerevadix Jacobs, which the right way round meant Black Victory. When the titles come up, White says, this must be the Joe Louis versus Max Schmeling fight. The Black Victory, see? I wish it had been. The film bored me to death. It was a series of doors opening and people coming into rooms, talking about an inheritance, then leaving. After door number 50 opened, I fell asleep. I was woken up by Files. Stop that bleeding snoring. I can't imagine what people on the other side of the screen thought as this inexplicable snoring was heard issuing from the film, where the will was being read. Home to dinner. We lay awake a long time, yarning about Christmas from yesteryear. Dean's asked what the film was like. It was, I said, a film where suddenly nothing happened all the time.
Friday, December the 17th, 1943. Today was like Tuesday the 14th without the Barts. We have a new M.O., a Captain Duggan from the R.E.M.C. He was a pink-looking Irishman with freckles, about 6 foot and tall with it. Thin, and a hat that seemed to be loose on his head. He walked about a bit like Jacques Tati. At the sick parade, all men felt worse after seeing him. He'd come from Kerry and been a small-town doctor, mostly farmers. Gunner Bailey went sick with a twisted and swollen ankle. He was given aspirins. Gunner Musselwhite went in with dermatitis and got castor oil. Jock Wilson went in with a boil on his nose and was told to run it onto the cold tap. "It stands to reason," said Bailey. "If you went in with appendicitis, he'd give you a holy picture and tell you to pray." A sticker for fresh air, Captain Duggan slept with the windows open. A week later, he was taken from us with bronchitis. As his stretcher was slid into the ambulance, a Scots voice was heard to cry, "Don't forget, run him under the cold tap." "It's mid-morning. There's lots of work everywhere, but nobody doing it. And where are we hiding?" "A small shed among some trees behind the big tower block. From it come low voices and palls of cigarette smoke. This is the hideaway. The inside reeked with gunners making tea and smoking. They are ignoring distant voices of sergeants calling, 'Where are you, you bastards?' The game is to make occasional appearances. We always left a skeleton staff on maintenance, while the bulk of the layabouts hid. It was Crown and Anchor with Di Poole. He brought the board up with the rations. He doled out our cigarette allowance. 1 hour later, he had won them all back again. I think today he has a villa on Malta and lung cancer." Saturday, December the 18th, 1943. Zounds! Great grundles of Gazolican! It's happened. I fear this day for many a month. There, in black and white, in clear language on part two orders. "Guard Commander, Lance Bombardier Milligan S, 954024. So, Milligan was trapped. There was one privilege. You got the afternoon off to prepare your kit. One could never place a brush to a boot without the remark, after another bloody strike, are we? I blankered my webbing, polished all my brass, then wrote a letter home. Major Evan Jenkins is driving his Batman Woody insane. He wants his battle dress hung up to attention. His boots angle out at 45 degrees. Mustn't put his hat upside down. It's an insult to the gun on a cap badge. As retribution, he used to swig Jenkins' whiskey, then top it up with water. And Jenkins used to wonder why he could never get pissed on it. Very good turnout, Bombardier, said Captain Sullivan of the guard mounting. Yes, I said. I wonder what's gone wrong. I saluted him. He saluted me. We saluted each other. Dismiss the men, Bombardier. I saluted. He saluted. We saluted. I saluted him. He saluted me. We saluted. They saluted. I turned smartly. Oh, guard, officer, breed. Yes, miss. New guard to the guard room. Yes, miss. Boots thumped on the cobbles, and the men trooped into the guard room, leaving driver Alf Files on first stag picking his nose. But I saw his nose, and I could have picked a better one. Like a good guard commander, I slept smartly to attention. I woke once when Gunner Jock Hall knocked the tea bucket over. I leapt to my feet and saluted it. Sunday, December the 19th, 1943. Next morning, I wrote in the guard report. 0545 hours. Tea bucket for the use of knocked over, spilling contest. Took immediate action and returned bucket to the upright position. Signed, Lance Bombardier Milligan S. The dawn was clear. Stars were still lingering in the morning sky. Underfoot, a hard white frost. The billet was still and quiet. Sleeping forms locked in their dreams. What better than to cheer them up this Christmas tide? Crash, clang, I dropped on my webby and said, God rest ye, merry gentlemen, may nothing ye dismay. Oh, dear, and why are you so dismayed? Here I was, awakening them so they would not be late on parade for the king. And what do I get? But wait, what is Gunner White saying to me? His hands around my throat. You bastard, today is Sunday. Is it Sunday? Today, say after me, today is Sunday. No gods on Sunday, are they? No gods on Sunday. The more religious had gone to Mass at RHQ. I didn't. I was a bad Catholic, and I didn't want to spoil my fine record. I wanted to be like my father. All his life he totally ignored his religion, but when he's told he's dying, suddenly, it's good Catholic time. Call a priest, he says. No, no, wait, no, no. Call a bishop. I want the best. In those moments before death, he was rebaptized 7 times, went to confession 12, and took communion 6 times. He used to say, "What's the use of being a good Catholic for 70 years? All you need is one confession before you die, and that makes up for all of it. And look at the time and money you've saved." The Sunday was all letter writing, yarning, darning holes in clothes, reading, and fishing in the canal. I spent an hour feeding worms to the fish and gave it up. Gunnar Miller of 18 Betty has a real line and is catching roach and dab, etc. He gave me 2. Ronnie May grilled them, and I gave 1 to Edgington. He complained bitterly. "It's full of bloody bones." "Of course it is," I said. "Everybody is. You fall down without them." December 20th, 1943. "You're looking forward to Christmas, Harry?" Edgington looks up from his mess tin. "I'm not sure, mate." "In one way, yes. In another, no. The no part is spending it away from home. You can't help feeling homesick, and it's worse at Christmas." "Yes," I said, "there's no place to be at Christmas except home." I thought of the Christmases I'd remembered from boyhood days in Pune. I remember the little room I slept in at the back of the house in 5 Clymer Road. The indescribable excitement of waking at 4 in the morning, the world of adults all silent, finding the pillowcases full of boxes and toys, and the magic as you unwrapped each one. I remember waking up at that very moment my mother and grandmother were putting the pillowcase at the bottom of my bed, explaining how Father Christmas has just gone. And when I asked which way he went, they pointed to the window. As it was covered with chicken wire, I worked out that he was magic and had got through the hole and was now a jigsaw puzzle. All that and more was moving in the memory bank of my past, and I too knew that Christmas on a farm in Italy could never be the real thing. Ted Lawrence, the Donar, brings news of Kijel. He's in Naples at the Rimi depot. Lucky buggers, billeted in the middle of Naples for 3 bloody weeks. Edgington appears to be reading his shirt. Remember that girl in Bexhill with the hairy legs who played Chopin? Yes, I said. That's all I ever think of, her and her hairy legs playing Chopin. I wonder what happened to her. I suppose, I said, she shaved her legs and is now playing Rachmaninoff. I remember the time we were pulling out of Bexhill. We pulled out in Bexhill. What was the poor girl's name? He ignored me. We were pulling out, and we were detailed to clean up the officer's billet. Ah, oh, wasn't that terrific? Yes. We were just finishing off, and when you spotted a crate of booze in the back of the garage, I remember one bottle was rum, and you and I started to sip it, remember? Yes, if I remember, I sipped the after bottle, and you sipped the rest. Yeah. We carried the bottles from Millwood, getting more and more pissed. We finally got out the other side on an infield road, and you remembered this bird because you'd tried to have it away with her, but she wouldn't have it because she was getting married. I know. I told her. I was trying to warm her up for the honeymoon. Yeah, followed you. Anyways, we arrived at her place. It was about midday, and she let us in, and you insisted that she played some Chopin with her hairy legs. Yes, I remember. No, that girl didn't half play me up. She took me home one night, straight into the bedroom, and laughed. She was a mass of woman's mag cliches. When I pulled her skirt up, she said, "Duh!" There was a flash of pink thigh and a rustle of silk petticoat. Then, when I kissed her, she turned her head away and said, she turned her head away and felt his warm breath on her neck. I began to think she was a dummy being worked by Barbara Cartland. When I gave up trying, I'd got to leave, and as I combed my hair, she said, he stood, nostrils twitching, combing his plum black hair. I never saw her after that, though she did leave a message at the battery office for me to contact her. "Tell him I changed my mind," was the exact communication. What it was she changed her mind about, I'll never know. Gunnar White is sitting on an oscillating petrol tin and reading from an old Bexhill Observer. Listen to this. German raiders attacked several points along the south-east coast. A bomb was dropped on a farm. The explosion blew the door off a bullpen. The bull made his way to the cow pasture, and the farmer had great difficulty in getting the bull back. He himself was attacked. Gunnerbert, shrouded in cigarette smoke, tells us that in a letter from home, his father told him there was a theory that Hitler was insane as a result of piles. Hitler has piles, chuckled Edgington. I don't know, said Birch. My father, he says it. Here he picked up the letter and read. Ron Lester, the publican, said that Hitler went mad through piles. He was operated on by a doctor, and the operation went wrong, and he still has them. It was a Jewish doctor, I said. That's why he had it in for the frontline skids. Don't tell me, said Edgington, sitting up. Don't tell me World War II is due to piles. What a sobering thought, I said.
to think a case of anusol suppositories could have stopped it.
It's not too late, said Edgington. We could load a Lancaster and drop 3 tons of pile ormond on his Reichstag.
You see, I said, nothing's safe these days, not even a man's Reichstag.
Bert blinked and listened to the conversation he had started.
What's a Reichstag, he said.
It's German for piles, I said.
Drooling.
Files has already mentioned this in his diary. Let me amplify. The Oxford Dictionary says, drooling, to drivel, to slaver.
I give you the lie. In our battery, drooling had an entirely different meaning.
It started on the farm. And in our case, the cause of drooling was sexual frustration. If you saw a lone gunner, for no perceptible reason, suddenly make a low groaning noise that sounded like woolly dooly, woolly dooly, at the same time appearing to grab an erect invisible phallus with both hands, which, by their position, suggested a chopper about 5 feet in length, that he then proceeded to thud against the nearest wall with a cry of woolly dooly thwack! Woolly dooly thwack! This was the new drooling craze. It was not abnormal to come into pre-pred gatherings of bored gunners, all apparently holding mighty invisible choppers, thudding them against walls, trees, and the ground. When Major Jenkins first witnessed this from a distance, he asked Sergeant Jock Wilson, "What are they doing, Sergeant?"
Wilson said, "It's something to do with the shortage, sir."
Jenkins parried, "The shortage of what?"
We don't know that, sir."
Travelling on the back of a lorry, the sight of a pretty girl immediately erupted into mass drooling until she was out of sight. Of late, the song Drooling had come to light. It was sung to the Flanagan Allen tune Dreaming.
Drooling, only just drooling. Each night we'll find the lads all drooling. A little loon don't hurt nobody. And if it does, we don't give a soddy. Drooling, drooling, it's so much better than tomfooling. A little drool can ease your heavy load. So keep drooling till your balls explode.
Apart from the laughing, the author is unknown, but he wants it that way. The farmyard square, now that it has been cleared of 300 years of dung, displayed a fine cobbled courtyard. The farmer, who had lived on this farm since he was born, said he didn't know it existed. The lovely tall tower of the main farm block afforded a good all-round view from its oval windows. That was repeated all up the staircase at 10 feet intervals. The tower had nothing to do with farming, nor had the building. It was obviously some landed gentry's country manor that had been vacated or sold cheaply to a farmer. The farmer kept horses, a few cattle, and grew crops along with a few fruit orchards. Define has returned from a fruitless fishing trip.
Are you sure there's fish in this canal?
Well, where else, you silly sod?
Then why didn't the fuckers bite? All I caught was this.
Oh, that's not a salmon, said Little. Not a bad guess. The creature was 3 inches long and black.
Oh, dear, said Deans in a female voice.
I've cooked all these chips and no fish. He stamped his foot on the floor, from which rose a cloud of coal dust, which turned him black.
Bombardier Fuller has arrived. There's a little line laying to be done. No panic, it's only a short one, about a quarter of a mile.
As we clamber aboard M2 truck, witness the spectacle of driver Ron Sherwood of Reading riding a bicycle backwards. Ask him to do a jog, and he's gone in a flash. But to ride a bicycle backwards, oh yes, he'll do that all day. Sherwood was a lovely footballer on the wing, with a slight tendency not to pass to anybody. And he wasn't a bad pianist. No, he was terrible. He'd get the right-hand melody going, for with the left hand he would hit any note. But he did it with such panache, a smile, a wink, and cloth-eared gunners would say, "Caw, you can't half-play that piano." And they were right, you could only half-play that piano. Very quickly we laid the line to RHQ. I opened the door to see a gaggle of our top officers all swigging whiskey. Among them was our dear Major Chaterjack, now a lieutenant colonel. It did not change him. He was still knocking them back. "Hello, Bombardier Milligan," he said warmly. "Nice to see you again, sir. Can you see me?" He laughed. With a few pleasantries exchanged, I connected up the Don 5 telephone. "There's some of the lads outside, sir, there." "Oh," he said, "I'll come and see them." From the top, he waved down to the lads on the truck. We all wished he never left us. It was the last time I would ever see him. The date was December the 16th, 1943. I remember the first time I'd seen him in Bexhill, a small, very dapper man, a weathered-faced, always ready to smile. I noticed he was wearing a very fine, brand-new pair of brogues. "A very nice shoe, sir," I said. "My batman doesn't like them." "Well, that's because he has to clean them, sir." "Oh, get away, Milligan." This Christmas concert party is bothering me, and I tell B.S.M. Griffin, "If we don't get a piano, we can't do the concert." "Oh, we can't have that," he said, his Welsh accent thick as Brecon Peaks. "It's going to be all right, Spake. Lieutenant Walker's going with you in a truck tomorrow to look for a piano." "Great." I tell Harry. "Oh, good," he says. "Pick a good one." "Pick one? They don't grow on bloody trees." "A 20-foot Bechstein, otherwise I refuse to play it." He and the others were on shit-scraping duties. This was the general title given to any cleaning jobs, and as the farm and the buildings seemed never to have been cleaned since the Renaissance, the crap was everywhere, mostly on the gunners.